I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Ron Bass joins me again. He's got a new book out, Midnight at the Savoy, a Priscilla Tempest Mystery, Book 5. It follows the fun and fascinating Priscilla Tempest and her swinging life in 1960s London, England, that is. Her day job is running the press office at the famed Savoy Hotel. This puts her in contact with all sorts of celebrities and powerful people. This book features the infamously difficult Rex Harrison and the legendary Marlene Dietrich, who was as seductive with Priscilla as we read in the book. We meet Priscilla's sister Phoebe, who comes from Toronto for a visit, and more. There's a murder at the beginning of the book, and Priscilla goes to the top of the suspect list. And as Priscilla goes about clearing her name, she enlists the help of Agatha Christie, who happens to be staying at the hotel. Ron started this series with the late Prudence Emery, who herself worked at the Savoy and later became a unit publicist for various film and television productions. She inspired the character of Priscilla Tempest, and as Ron says, she was very much on his mind as he wrote this new book. Like the gal herself, the books are fun and fascinating, and they're solid mysteries that come alive with these appearances of notable names. And that Priscilla is Canadian provides a unique insight in how the British are viewed and how they view those who are American and Canadian. Ron Bass is a former newspaper and magazine journalist and movie critic. His works include 20 novels, 2 novellas, and 4 nonfiction books. He's written screenplays and worked with legendary filmmakers such as John Boorman and Roland Joffe. He divides his time between Milton, Ontario, where I reached him last Sunday, and Fort Myers, Florida. Visit ronbasebooks.com for more. This new book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Ron Bass. Mr. Bass, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. It's good to talk to you again. Always fun to do one of these interviews.
It's nice to talk to you. So I've spent the last 2 days starting the book, and I'll have the next 2 days off to finish the book. I'm really enjoying it. The thing that I love about the books is that it reminds me, because, you know, I tend to forget, what sort of person Priscilla is like and the sort of personality that she has, because she... we see that in the way she interacts with people, you know, whether it's the famous or the powerful. She doesn't really give a shit, does she? And it's a sort of Canadian sensibility, I guess, that defines her, because when you try to figure out what she is, she definitely isn't American and she isn't British, is she?
No, absolutely not. And I think, you know, it's how she's reacting in a world that's basically male-driven. You know, at that time, the Savoy, you know, I think we talked about this before, but at the Savoy in the late 1960s, they're basically the only women who worked there were, you know, the housekeepers. So it was a very, very male-driven society that she finds herself in, and I think what makes her more interesting is the way that she reacts against it, that, yes, she's got a kowtow to the general manager, Clive Banville, who would love to get rid of her. But she finds a way to, you know, quietly rebel against the way she's being treated as a woman. And I think the great thing about it is that one of the ways that she rebels against all this treatment is to solve a mystery, to do what the police and no one else can do, which is to find out who the killer is.
And we'll talk about that in just a sec. But I mean, not being English or American, that's something that Marlene Dietrich notices when we first see her in the book, don't we?
Right. Yes, she's. At that point in her career, she was somewhat finished in Hollywood and quite disdainful of America and Hollywood. So I think she finds Priscilla refreshing on the one hand, and on the other hand, she's attracted to her as well.
Yeah. So for people listening to us, if you had to sort of place her in the celebrity universe of the 1960s, her best films were behind her, so she was working on the stage and as a singer, right?
Correct, yes. Most of her she'd made a couple of things, A Touch of Evil with Orson Welles, of course.
Right.
Which was her most famous of her later films. But basically, yeah, she was a cabaret singer. She had done, you know, as I say, in the book, witness for the prosecution for Billy Wilder. And this is, you know, I think Agatha Christie's best play, actually. Mm. And although at that point the play wasn't being revived at the Savoy Theater, but I sort of manipulated things around a bit so that she's appearing on stage with Rex Harrison in a production of Agatha Christie's Witness for the Prosecution, which would have been a great production to see, incidentally. I'm sorry, yeah. I never saw it.
Yeah. And so Agatha Christie's around the theater and the hotel as well, isn't she?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. I thought it was a great excuse to introduce her because she was very much present at that point and doing plays. And she's just kind of a fascinating character who ends up helping Priscilla solve the mystery. So it was great. I mean, we've talked about this before, too, but because the Savoy at that point was the place to see and be seen, all these celebrities, you know, just about anybody who was anybody would show up at the Savoy, and it just seemed, you know, impossible not to use real celebrities from time to time in as the stories unfold, and it makes it a lot of fun too.
Yeah. Did you read, by the way, a lot of Agatha Christie growing up?
Good question. I don't think I did. I think since we started to write these books, I've read more of her. Saw a lot of the movie, saw most of the movie yeah. versions of her books, you know, as a kid or as a young man. Lately, I've read more of her books and sort of looked into what the machinery that she used yeah. to create these mysteries. There's a book that was published years ago that I came across in a used bookstore about her Agatha Christie's notebooks, and she kept voluminous notes about each book that she did, and somebody's put those between years ago, put it between covers, and I found that quite fascinating, the way she mapped these mysteries out before she started to write them.
Well, what do you think it says, Ron, about her work especially? I mean, you know, they came out as books first, and then came movies, and then they get revived in television, you know, every generation.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, these mysteries, we already know what happens, but, I mean, they're still good fodder, aren't they?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you look at her today, the last time we were in London, because I was writing the Midnight at the Savoy at the time, we went to see, finally, The Mousetrap, which is the longest-running play in theatrical history. And it's an old chestnut of a thing that you just kind of shake your head at the plot mechanics of it all, and you can't imagine how it's become the longest-running play in the history of English-language theater, basically.
Yeah.
So, and it's still going on, and they give you, if you buy the Mousetrap play, which of course I did, you get a number, the number of the edition of the play that you've seen. So it's almost a ritual that people go to see this play, but I find a lot of her work is rather mechanical. You know, you're supposed to, in the theory of Agatha Christie and a lot of these cozy mysteries, you as the reader are supposed to be able to follow the clues and figure this out yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I find myself not being able to figure out any of the stuff that Agatha Christie writes, except you could always count on the most unlikely person in the unfolding drama. It turns out to be the killer or the murderer.
Yeah.
And if you work it that way, often you can guess who the murderer is. But it's a formula that everybody uses. You know, these knives out Netflix movies, the Thursday Murder Club things. Everybody, including yours truly, to a certain extent, uses this formula. But it seems to work for people. And we can all thank, going back to the golden age of mystery, where there were a lot of similar authors around doing the same sort of thing that Agatha Christie did. Mm-hmm. But she outlasted everybody. So we all owe her, in this type of mystery at least, a debt of gratitude.
So there is a dead guy at the beginning of the book, and he's in a Rolls Royce in the driveway of the Savoy. There's a note accompanying the body. You know, the funny thing is, I was reading the book, is today a simple look at the camera footage, I guess, would figure out what would happen. But I guess that's the attraction of writing something set in the past, that it can become a terrific creative experience, right?
Well, you don't have to worry about cell phones. You don't have to worry about CCTV cameras, which, you know, if you watch a British police procedural these days or even a modern-day mystery, you know, they constantly have to deal with these CCTV cameras that are everywhere in London, and which is why you see a lot of these things that are set in rural villages, because there's not so many cameras around. But you do have to deal with these things, you know, if you watch contemporary mysteries, particularly in the streaming mysteries, they're constantly on cell phones. Everybody's on a cell phone constantly. And you don't have to worry. Sometimes it gets in the way because somehow Priscilla or whoever it is has to find a telephone booth to make a call.
Yeah.
But in those days, there were so many, red telephone boxes around in Britain that it's not usually too hard to find a telephone for Priscilla when she needs one.
Yeah.
But you don't have to worry about a lot of that stuff, and it makes it much easier in a way, and much more fun to write these mysteries.
Yeah. So the body has this note, and Priscilla's name is written in it.
Correct.
And so she's automatically a suspect in the guy's murder.
She's never seen the person. She has no idea who this person is.
Yeah, and it says a lot that she's automatically pinned as the main suspect. It says something about the people investigating.
They exactly. But, of course, Priscilla often is at first suspected because she's in the wrong place at the wrong time, and she's a different breed of woman than British police are used to dealing with. So it kind of works that she's always under suspicion. I don't know precisely that they think that she knocked this guy off, but they certainly have their suspicions. She's not telling them the full story.
So the first time,
as it turns out.
Yeah, because the first time we see her in the book, she's in bed. She's at home in bed with somebody else's husband, right?
Correct. And this is another thing that I think makes her a little more interesting. Because it is 1968, because it is swinging London, supposedly, and the whole sexual revolution is supposedly unfolding, I think it makes, and she's a young, single, attractive woman in London in that period, and I just think it makes it, it gives a little more of an edge to the mysteries that they wouldn't ordinarily have, but that you can't ignore, really, given the time and the setting of the books. So I think it makes Priscilla just a little more interesting and a little more sexual than a lot of heroines are in the books in that period.
Yeah, she's somebody, what makes her such a captivating character is that she's somebody who seems to attract men, and in this book, Marlene Dietrich, whether they're available or not.
Yes, well, she attracts, put it, as she beats herself up, she attracts the wrong men. Often attracts the wrong men. So, and she doesn't want to get married. You know, she's pretty adamant about that. Although, you know, the man she knows very well that she shouldn't marry is the Standard reporter Percy Hoskins. But she's attracted to him, but she knows darn well she should stay away from him.
Well, we'll talk about Rex Harrison in just a second, but this brings up another a comparison in terms of characters. I mean, her sister Phoebe arrives from Canada, and she's nothing like Priscilla, is she?
No, and that's often the case. Is there's the strong, sexy sister, and then there's the not so strong, slightly younger sister who has operated in the shadow of her big sister over the years, and I just thought that would make an interesting contrast to have Phoebe arrive in London and kind of get turned around by her association with Priscilla.
Yeah.
So again, just you know, balancing these characters, playing these characters off one another, and you know, probably we've talked about before, I think what makes these kinds of books work is the conflict in them. And the conflict can work on various levels. Phoebe and Priscilla, a murder mystery where the police suspect Priscilla. The conflict in the putting on the production of witness for the prosecution. So they're always, and the conflict that Priscilla encounters in her day-to-day business, trying not to get fired by the general manager of the hotel. So all of these things, I kind of work together, but there's always a fair amount of conflict, and I think that makes, you know, any book more readable.
You know, I've seen the film, the Billy Wilder Witness for the Prosecution, probably half a dozen times, and I could watch it again another half a dozen times. It was revived recently, I think, for television or for the radio at least, and in the book you're talking about a theater production.
It's revived. It's
regularly,
it's on now in the
yeah.
West End in London, and it what gave me the idea was seeing it a couple of years ago at the Shaw Festival.
Mm.
A very good production of it. I mean, it is her best play, and it counts on a kind of mechanical turn of events that is kind of hard to swallow, but it kind of works for the play.
Yeah, I mean, it's just another thing. I mean, if they said tomorrow that there was a production in town, I'd go see it. Even though I know what happens, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those things that you cannot not see if you know what I mean. So in this production that Dietrich is supposed to be on the stage in London, her co-star is Rex Harrison, who we meet early in the book, quite drunk, and then
as he often was.
Mm-hmm.
Like.
When he interacts with Priscilla the next morning, he's very hungover. He's very chatty, even though he says he's not in the mood to talk at all. But he says a lot, doesn't he?
Right.
I'm sure you've had encounters with celebrities like that over the years. You know, not pleasant ones, say.
Yeah, I mean, usually people are on pretty good behavior because you are there. You're interviewing them, and they know full well it's going to appear in the paper. I saw Rex Harrison on stage. In fact, I never met him personally, but I saw him a number of times on stage, including in Los Angeles, a revival of My Fair Lady. And he really was marvelous to watch on the stage, no matter what his rather sketchy personal life was like with his five wives, and et cetera, et cetera. But he was a marvel to watch on stage, and I loved him on the screen as well.
Yeah.
And that kind of actor just doesn't exist anymore. The suave Englishman with the great voice, and just quietly authoritative demeanor about them, and just very elegant. getting very sophisticated. And that kind of actor, Cary Grant would be the template for that sort of thing. But that kind of actor just doesn't exist anymore. So it's always that was fun to see a Rex Harrison on the screen, or a Christopher Plummer, or certainly Cary Grant to bring these things off. And I think that Roger Moore was a little bit like that, not nearly as good as Harrison was, but a troubled man in his personal life, as we see in the book. And the great thing about it is, again, what's interesting, I find, is that often people don't know who these people are in real life.
Yeah.
So if you don't know who Rex Harrison is, you can treat him as just an eccentric character in the book. You don't necessarily have to know who these celebrities are, but it just adds a little more to your enjoyment of the book if you do.
Yeah, it does. But by the way, you mentioned Cary Grant, and there's a reference to him early on in the book about him being cheap. Was he cheap like Fred McMurray was cheap?
Cary Grant had the reputation of never picking up a check at lunch. He was regarded as pretty cheap.
And so I guess that's something you've known for a long time. And I'm wondering, sort of these sort of things that drop in the book in conversation about other people, especially. Do you have to do some research at all in terms of how you, say, even just mention somebody in passing, somebody who did exist, say?
Yeah, I think for years wrote about movies. I wrote about old movies, new movies, hopeful movies. I'm pretty well versed in all of that sort of thing. And certainly, to this day, love old movies, love those celebrities from that era. I mean, it was a remarkable era, in the fact that you had all these emerging British stars, the Sean Connerys, the Albert Finneys, the Michael Caines. You had people still around like John Wayne and Henry Fonda and Cary Grant, although he retired a few years before the books were set. There were all these people. Catherine Hepburn was still around, yet the Sophia Lorenz and a whole group of emerging actors were coming out. So it was an absolutely fascinating time, and movie stars were movie stars in those days as well. That movie stars could open if you're Steve McQueen, you could open a movie. People wanted Steve McQueen because he could attract an audience on its opening weekend. Well, that's pretty much gone out the window now. There aren't many stars that you say, gee, honey, get your coat on. We're going to go to the theater and see Adam Driver. Well, you're not. So that's all changed. It's fun to go back and do that. But I do research, of course.
Yeah.
And, we've talked about my beloved and much missed collaborator, Prudence Emery. Prudence was there, as we've talked before. Prudence was there in the late '60s, and herself met a lot of the people that Noel Coward was a friend of hers, and that sort of thing. So she was a great help in doing some of these personalities because she personally knew them.
Yeah, I guess that gossip, if you will, because it's not even gossip at some point. It's who they were. This information about them personally, it adds another layer to the mythos and the celebrity and the sort of, and how we remember them too, right?
Yeah, you can. I mean, I guess it's, if you write a book about Henry VIII, or a novel about Henry VIII, you're still taking the reality of somebody famous, taking the information that we now know about them, and making use of it in a fictional context. And as I say, it makes it a little more fun.
Yeah. So this was the first Priscilla Tempest mystery that you've written without Prudence Emery. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah. Sadly, yes. So,
what was it like, though, as you were writing? Did you sense her at all? Did you feel her presence as you were writing, say?
Well, I did. I mean, I always, you know, for Priscilla, I mean, people have asked me over the years if they make these into a streaming series yeah. or a movie, who would you want to cast? And I can't get past the thought of Prudence, Prue. You know, there's a picture of, I think of as a rather iconic photograph of her on the roof of the Savoy as in the years when she worked there. And this young, fresh, long-legged, lovely-looking woman is Prue in the photograph. And I can't get past the image of her when I'm writing these books. I mean, Prudence wasn't all that comfortable with the comparisons, but I always think of Prudence when I write about Priscilla, and that helps to write the book. So yeah, she's very much in my memory. You know, she's kind of looking over my shoulder. She was always great about, you know, you can't go left on the Strand, you've got to go right kind of thing. So I certainly miss that. But I think she imbued me with enough knowledge and enough confidence to go on without her. And, you know, the fact that the book has, there's been this kind of reaction to the book, from you and others is encouraging, to say the least. But, you know, she's always going to play a part in these books. I would never in a million years have written a mystery novel about the Savoy if it wasn't for Prudence. So, you know, without her, there wouldn't have been these books.
Yeah. So this is the fifth book. There will be a sixth, will there?
There is a sixth. You interrupted me, Joe, as I'm putting the finishing touches to the sixth book, in fact, The Secret of the Savoy.
What sort of feedback have you gotten over the years from readers? And I'm curious to know if the feedback is at all useful as you continue writing these books.
Good question. The feedback has been mostly positive. I think in the early going, some of the people either like people loved Priscilla, or they thought that she wasn't fleshed out enough. That we at that point didn't spend enough time on her background and where she came from and this sort of thing. But that was a decision that we made at the time, was to keep the plot moving, that the character would come out of the dialogue and the situations that Prudence or that Priscilla found herself in. So that was a criticism that I kind of address in this book with introducing Phoebe and her and Priscilla's old boyfriend shows up. So I guess I kind of paid some attention to that feedback at the time. What we used to call a criticism, Joe.
I love getting to know a little bit more about her in this book. And the other thing that I was thinking about as I'm reading Midnight at the Savoy is I'm sure there were readers out there who just can't wait for the sixth book, and who have found Priscilla their own, if you will. There's sort of become proprietary of her and what she gets herself into. Do you hear from people like that?
To a certain extent, yes. I think, again, you and I have talked about this, but I previously did a series of mystery novels set in along the west coast of Florida, the Sanibel Sunset Detective Mysteries. I did 15 of those over the years. And people, because I was down there and I was out there a lot doing book signings and interviews like this one and this sort of thing, that people really, and people would come back every year for the latest, and every fall, or every fall, that there would be a new Sanibel Sunset detective novel. And because it was such a contained area, the west, along the west coast of Florida, and so many people flowed in from all the other states and from, you know, around the world, really, that people got to know me, and they got to know the books. And I got they loved the characters in those books and came back each year for them. Mm-hmm. I don't get so much of this with the Priscilla Tempest novels, I think because they're spread across a wider area. They're published here, they're published in the States, they're published in France. So I don't get the contained readership that I enjoyed for years when I was writing these Sanibel Sunset detective novels in Florida. But the response is good, and people do focus on Priscilla, and certainly the reviews focus on her as well.
Yeah. You know, I had to chuckle a moment ago when you mentioned Adam Driver.
I was just reading something about him, I guess.
I think I probably read the same thing that you did, I guess, in response to something that Lena Dunham had written about him in her memoir. Do you... Like I was thinking of Rex Harrison as well in this book. When you know of, say, bad behavior, does that color how you view their work?
No, usually not. I think that you've got to, you know, I know it's controversial to say these things these days, but I think you've got to divide. You know, Woody Allen's a very good example. I'm a huge fan of his work. I mean, not everything is great. Not everything is what you want it to be. But as a body of work, I think it's fairly impressive, very impressive. And even into now entering his 90s, he's still making another movie. The way he's been vilified when there are no charges ever laid, no real evidence other than what the family has said, no evidence that he ever sexually abused anybody else. Nobody else has come forward to accuse him of anything. So I just try to put all that other stuff aside, as difficult as it is with somebody like Woody Allen. You just have to put some of this aside. I mean, otherwise you'd never watch a Warner Brothers movie, because Jack Warner every afternoon shut down the studio and had sex with somebody different every day, supposedly.
Yeah. Bringing up Allen is a good point, because I remember when Diane Keaton died recently. One of the first things I thought about was that I needed to watch Annie Hall again. And you know, on Allen, I happen to believe, you know, all the negative things about him, but that doesn't stop me from watching Annie Hall or watching Manhattan Murder Mystery or you know, some of his other films. I'm just not going to particularly laud him. I mean, Annie Hall is as much a Diane Keaton movie or a Gordon Willis movie as it is a Woody Allen movie, I think.
Right, right.
You know? And I certainly am not going to, if I'm going to watch his new movie, I'm not going to tell people about it. You know what I mean? So,
I think you have to, you wouldn't, you know, some people were just not very nice in real life.
Yeah.
That's human behavior. Rex Harrison was not by any estimation a particularly a nice person, and the way he treated some of his wives, it was you know, I mean, Kay Kendall committed died almost not knowing that she was ill. One of his wives committed suicide, and he wouldn't remarry her, and blah blah. So I, you know, but To see Rex Harrison on the screen is still a joy.
Yeah.
However, what it does do is make these characters much more interesting to write about than they otherwise would be. No, I'll tell you the one person that disappointed me is the author John le Carré. You know, the spy who came in from the cold, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. A huge fan of his. He was a great influence over the years in my writing. I've followed him since I was a kid, working from The Spy Who Came In From the Cold onward. And to read post his death, that his biographer has written a book that he couldn't write when le Carré was alive, but all the affairs that he had. And it wasn't that John le Carré would find himself doing a book presentation and a fan came along and he ended up in bed with her. I mean, he was a real serial Lothario out there. As soon as he got out of town, away from his wife, was out there hunting relationships. I mean, quite blatantly, he lived a secret. So it wasn't that John le Carré said he lived a secret life that he couldn't talk about, and everybody thought, oh, well, it was because he was a spy.
Yeah,
it wasn't because he was a spy. He was out because he was out having sex with everybody he could get his hands on. That was his secret life.
Mm.
So I was a little bit disappointed by all that. I just, particularly the betrayal of his wife and his family. It's one thing if you're single and, you're divorcing your wife,
sure,
or whatever the reason is. But, you know, he kept that marriage together for years. She kind of looked the other way. And while he went out and, to use an old-fashioned term, philandered. Mm. So that kind of disappointed me. But
I could talk all morning with you, but I'll let you go in just a sec. One last question. Where do you like writing best?
Well, I try to run it like a, going to work every day.
Uh-huh.
I get up, mind you, we hit my jet lag right at the moment. I mean, just got back from Europe. But so I'm usually up, around 8 in the morning these days. And I'm right across, my office is right across the hall from our bedroom. I go in there, write for a while, have some breakfast, hopefully work out on a rowing machine or do push-ups, try and stay young forever, Joe.
Yeah.
and then go back to work. So I usually run out of steam in mid-afternoon, but I do, you know, try to keep a daily schedule along those lines. And but again, it comes from being in journalism for years. You no matter what happened, when I was in the newspapers, no matter what happened, if your parents died, your wife left you, the dog died, didn't make any difference. You had to be in there and finish the story.
Yeah.
So I kind of still operate with that mindset.
Now, you were a critic for many years. When you watch film or television today, are you able to turn that part of your brain off, the critic part, or are you watching for enjoyment?
I find it increasingly difficult to completely turn my brain off. But I still, my wife Kathy and I, and Kathy's a huge movie fan as well. We still go to the movies.
Mm.
You know, if there's something to see, we just saw the Wizard of the Kremlin yesterday, which is a terrific movie about a young man who helped bring Putin to power and pays the price for it. It's based on fact, but it's a fictionalized account of this. Very, very good movie. So if there's something really good to see, we're still there in the movie theater. So, particularly watching a lot of the streaming stuff,
mm-hmm.
I do find myself going, oh, God, there's an awful lot of padding on these things, particularly if they're only 6, 7, or 8 episodes. And I do find my putting my critical hat on probably more than I used to.
Yeah. Again, I could talk all day with you. I so appreciate your time.
I could do the same thing, Joe. Thank you.
I'll look forward to the next book.
Well, I look forward to the next book, if only I can talk to you again. So it's always great fun. So thank you very much for taking the time to do this.
You're very kind. And continue good luck with Midnight at the Savoy and everything else.
Well, thank you ever so much. Same to you. Hope you're feeling better.
The website for more is at ronbasebooks.com. Midnight at the Savoy, a Priscilla Tempest Mystery Book 5, is out now from Douglas and McIntyre. Its author, Ron Bass, joined me on the line from Milton, Ontario. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.